From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Election 2000, A Space Odyssey. Texan Jim Hightower speaks his mind on the current field of presidential candidates. As he says, if the gods had meant us to vote, they would have given us candidates. And the latest on the Elian Gonzalez case, his grandmothers have returned to Cuba without him. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The bullets tore into Amadou Diallo's heart, spinal cord, lungs, liver, spleen, kidneys, and intestines. The unarmed African immigrant was killed instantly in the barrage from four white city cops. Nearly a year after Diallo's death in New York City's Bronx Borough, an upstate jury must decide whether the shooting was a murder or a horrible mistake. Jury selection begins today. In a surprise decision last month, an appeals court moved the racially charged case to the New York State Capitol, agreeing with the defense that a wave of pretrial publicity and protests had made it impossible for the officers to get a fair trial in New York City. Last week, the judge ruled the trial could be televised. So this case has been moved from the overwhelmingly black and Latino borough of the Bronx to one of the whitest areas of New York State, the state capital in Albany. We'll be bringing you daily reports. Cheered by flag-waving Cubans, the grandmothers of Elian Gonzalez returned to Cuba yesterday to a celebrity welcome after a U.S. trip that stirred public opinion but failed to bring their grandson home. Thousands of Cuban citizens turned out to give a warm and massive reception to the grandmothers, Mariela Quintana and Raquel Rodriguez. Bursting into tears at the end of the official welcome, Elian's maternal grandmother Rodriguez expressed sorrow that they had not returned with their grandson. She said, "We have to keep fighting. We promised Elian we would bring him back to Cuba." The High Court today in London rejected a request by Belgium and six human rights groups to challenge the secrecy of the medical report that could free former Chilean dictator General Augusto Pinochet. Belgium said it would appeal Justice Maurice Kay's decision to a three-judge High Court panel. That means the case will not yet revert to Britain's top law enforcement official for a final ruling on whether Pinochet can be extradited to Spain. Home Secretary Jack Straw announced earlier this month that he is inclined to let the 84-year-old general return home, saying an independent medical team found the former dictator mentally unfit to stand trial on charges of human rights abuses. But he said he would wait to rule until the judicial challenges have ended. Late polls suggest about a third of New Hampshire voters have yet to make up their minds about a presidential nominee for tomorrow's primary. The surveys indicate the Republican race has narrowed to a dead heat between John McCain and George W. Bush. McCain and Bush are tied in several of the latest polls, and McCain is ahead in a couple of others. On the Democratic side, Vice President Al Gore continues to lead in several polls, but the margin has slipped to under 10 points. Analysts say Gore has firmed up support among men and independents. Opponents of the death penalty are praising plans by the state of Illinois to block executions while its capital punishment system is investigated. The Chicago Tribune reports Governor George Ryan of Illinois made the decision in reaction to Illinois' record of exonerating more death row prisoners than it executes. Since the death penalty was reinstated in 1977, 13 death row prisoners in Illinois have been cleared, one more than the number of prisoners the state has executed. The official announcement of the new policy is expected today. It would make Illinois the first state in the country to stop all executions to review its death penalty procedures. This news from Rhode Island. A black off-duty policeman was mistaken for a suspect and shot to death by two fellow officers responding to a fight at a diner early Friday. Cornell Young Jr., dressed in street clothes, saw a man confronting the two officers outside the restaurant and rushed to help them with his gun drawn, this according to the police chief. The officers ordered Young to drop his weapon. When he didn't, they fired, said the police chief. Young, the 29-year-old son of the highest-ranking black member of the Providence Police Department, died at a hospital. The man who originally confronted the on-duty officers was charged with murder. This week, about 75 people representing civil rights groups, churches, and black advocacy groups asked Rhode Island lawmakers to approve a 2-year review of traffic stops to determine whether state troopers engage in racial profiling. The government has conceded for the first time that workers who helped make nuclear weapons were exposed to cancer-causing radiation and chemicals, this according to the New York Times. The findings that radiation exposure led to higher than normal and wide-ranging cancers in workers is detailed in a draft report prepared by the Energy Department and the White House.
Well, I just got back from Roswell, where the aliens have been. And if you ask the feds the cause, well, they'll only lie again. Now I'm hunted by the gumshoes, and I'm wanted by the cops, 'cause they think that I might be the guy making circles in the crops. And I know that there's a conspiracy from the voices in my head. Elvis lives, that's clear to me. It's McCartney who is dead. And if the Mars man should come again and take me, I will go. I will take a trip on their rocket ship. God bless the UFO.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Tomorrow is the country's first presidential primary, the year 2000. And for the past few weeks, residents of the tiny white state of New Hampshire have been inundated with the circus-like atmosphere of the presidential campaign. From candidates' visits to diners to the endless polling phone calls to the media frenzy that accompanies the candidates wherever they go. With races tightening both for the Democrats and the Republicans, Democrat Bill Bradley and Republican Senator John McCain are trying to woo independent voters who are now on the fence between the two candidates, voters who are allowed to cast ballots for either political party. The race between Texas Governor George W. Bush and McCain remains too close to call, while the latest tracking poll shows Vice President Al Gore ahead of Bradley. Abortion has been an issue in New Hampshire. Although the polls indicate the voters are not as concerned about it, the candidates are certainly seeing this as a place for a platform to express themselves nationally. John McCain walked a verbal tightrope on abortion yesterday in a bid to avoid riling single-issue voters who could tip his close presidential primary race with Bush. The Texas governor took a position similar to McCain's on the volatile issue, favoring repeal of Roe versus Wade and a ban, with several exceptions. But he escaped a detailed grilling as the candidates made the final rounds of TV talk shows yesterday. On NBC's Meet the Press, the Arizona Senator McCain said his respect for life puts him on the side of those promoting an abortion ban, with exceptions for rape, incest, and danger to the mother's health, life. When pressed about the seeming contradictions in his position, McCain said, "These are all moral problems that we have to work out for ourselves. The life of the mother is obviously a human life, too. The gripping aspects of rape and incest are terrible situations. I don't claim to be a theologian, but I have my own moral beliefs." While McCain is keeping up attacks on special interests and campaign financing, Bradley has also increased his criticism of the source of Gore's financial contributions, questioning his role in the fundraising scandal that dogged the Democrats after the 1996 elections, particularly raising questions about a Buddhist fundraiser that the vice president attended. Meanwhile, the Bush campaign has already surpassed the $63 million mark, and while Bush claimed on the campaign trail that he, too, would go after special interests, most campaign watchers predict his coffers will soon be taking in millions of dollars in soft money. To deal with all of this, we now turn to a recent speech by Jim Hightower. He's a radio talk show host and former Secretary of Agriculture of Texas. He recently wrote a new book called If the Gods Had Meant for Us to Vote, They Would Have Given Us Candidates. This is a speech he recently gave in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and it's called The Presidential Campaign 2000, A Space Odyssey. Go back to music. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue with that speech of Jim Hightower's. Jim Hightower is twice an elected official in the state of Texas. He was the Secretary of Agriculture. I got a chance to spend a little time with him in the battle in Seattle, where we both did our daily talk shows. And in just a minute, we'll go to that speech.
Well, I just got back from Roswell, where the aliens have been. And if you ask the feds the cause, well, they'll only lie again. Now I'm hunted by the gumshoes, and I'm wanted by the cops, 'cause they think that I might be the guy making circles in the crops.
Now this is Jim Hightower.
Thank you all. Thank you very much. Very much. A joy for me to be here in this center of enlightenment and erudition here at the wonderful educational institution in which we are gathered. And to see people, I'm a little worried as a Texan that there are people actually behind my back. This is not make me at all comfortable, but nonetheless, we will proceed as though nothing untoward is going to happen at all. But I really want to thank the leaders of this great bunch that would allow a scrawny Texan like me to come in here as a populist agitator and to visit with you good folks here. And mostly I want to talk about what's on your mind, so I will try to hold my smart-ass remarks as briefly as I possibly can. Being a Texan, I've got to run my mouth here for a while. But, you know, a preacher friend of mine once taught me the three B's of speaking. He said, be speaking, be brief, and be sitting down. And that's what I'll try to do with you here. So I'm honored to be a part of this gathering with you here and to talk about some of the things that I think will not be talked about in the coming presidential exercise, which I refer to in my new book as Election 2000, A Space Odyssey. Too weird even for Stanley Kubrick to possibly try to explain to us. It will, I predict, be yet another money-soaked, corporate-directed, issue-evading, made-for-TV snoozer of an election that will produce the lowest turnout since perhaps Calvin Coolidge and John Davis excited the public so much back in 1924, a period actually remarkably similar to what we have today, a period in which, in 1924, the media was giddy with the prosperity that was sweeping our nation at the time, ignoring the fact that most people actually were not enjoying any of that prosperity, ignorant of the looming depression just 5 years down the road for them. In fact, Calvin Coolidge, elected in 1924, said as the depression began to spread across the land that when more and more people are thrown out of work, unemployment results. Now, I know he was never the brightest bulb on the block, but surely somebody was fiddling with his dimmer switch that night when he came up with that. But I'm afraid we have the same level of determined ignorance that will be expressed by George W. Bush, Shrub, as we call him in Texas. He doesn't quite measure up even to a Bush. We'll get to that later. But also Al Gore, Jr., whom his mother even described as a born conformist, Bill Bradley, all three the likely nominees of the Republicrats in the year 2000 for President of the United States. I think we'll not hear, for example, a whisper about the mugging of the middle class that is taking place in our country. I don't think we'll hear any talk at all about the need for a single-payer health care plan to cut out the HMOs and the insurance company greed heads and cover every single American with an insurance policy that is would spend less money, cost less money than we now spend. I don't think we'll hear anything about the need for public financing of our elections to get not only the corporate money out of the process, but also to give ordinary Americans the chance to run for political office again. I don't think we'll hear much about the god of globalization which is just another form of globaloney, and we'll get into that a little bit later, too. I mentioned at the top of this little talk here about being an agitator. Now, that's considered a pejorative in today's society, right? Agitators, them outside agitators. Our workers were perfectly happy until those agitators came into our factory. Poor people over on the other side of town, they were just doing fine. They had no objection at all till outside agitators came in and stirred them up. Well, hogwash. Agitation is what America's all about. Were it not for agitation, we'd all be sitting here tonight wearing white powdered wigs and singing God Hail the Queen, would we not? Agitation actually made America, and I don't mean just the founders. If you look at that founding democracy, 1776 forward, let's start with the Declaration of Independence, and through the first presidential election, in that election, less than 4% of the American people were even eligible to vote. Did you know that? Women couldn't vote, they were chattel. African Americans couldn't vote, they were slaves. Native Americans, they were heathens. If you did not own property, you could not vote. You were riffraff. Only 4% of the American people could vote in the first presidential election. But what happened was the democratizing force that was turned loose in 1776. The Thomas Paines and the Daniel Shays, Sojourner Truth and Frederick Douglass, the Populists and the Wobblies, the Upton Sinclairs and Ida Tarbells, Huey Long and John L. Lewis, Martin Luther King and Cesar Chavez in more recent days, and now to you and me, agitators. That's what we've got to be in this country. Agitation, nothing wrong with that. Think of it like this. The agitator is the center post in the washing machine that gets the dirt out. Nothing wrong with that, is there? We need a lot more agitation. And been my joy over the years to work with citizen agitators all across the country, taking on the forces of ignorance and arrogance, battling the powers that be on behalf of the powers that ought to be, the ordinary working people in this country. Now, that's not an easy task, and I don't need to tell you about it because here you are in Colorado Springs. Where challenging the powers that be can be quite dangerous, actually. You know, you get to feeling like that guy that B.B. King sang about. Nobody likes you but your mama, and she might be jiving you too. You ever been there? Ever had that feeling? Well, we need your fighting spirit more than ever before. The spirit of folks like you, who are right here challenging those forces of ignorance and arrogance in a place that is not easy to do it. But the good news is, you're winning. All right, you're not winning every fight. All right, there's not a single Democrat elected here in the area. But that doesn't mean you're not making progress. It doesn't mean you're not striking blows. It doesn't mean that you're not crossing lines and reaching a broader community and building something that is more important even than a Democratic Party. It means that you're building a people's movement. And what I'm here to tell you is quite simply this. It's not enough for us to be progressive anymore. We've got to become aggressive again, because the powers that be are radically regressive, running roughshod over working families, roughshod over family farmers and small business people, running roughshod over not merely the poor people, but now over the middle class as well, roughshod over old folks and children, roughshod over our environment and our hope for a better tomorrow. A small digression here at the top. Don't let these powers that be trivialize and marginalize what it is you're fighting for. They'll say to labor, oh, labor just wants another dollar an hour. That's all they care about. They say to farmers, well, you're just wanting another nickel a bushel on grain, on wheat. And they say to folks fighting for clean air and clean water, oh, you just want more regulations. They say to people who care about their neighborhoods, well, you just want more bureaucracy. Well, that is not the case at all. What we're fighting for is not about bureaucracies. It's not about budgets. What we're fighting for at the city hall level, at the legislative level, at the national level, is what America actually stands for, what Americans believe in their hearts. I'm talking about the founding values of our nation, And this is a little different than some of the family values you hear so much about. I'm talking about the founding values of our country. What are those? Pretty radical thoughts, really. Economic fairness. That's radical. Social justice. Equal opportunity for all people. Isn't that what all of our fights get down to? Economic fairness, social justice, equal opportunity for all people. It's not about bureaucracies and budgets. It's about the big values that we as a people represent. It's about the big values that the American democratic experiment makes possible for us even to think about achieving. Very few people in the world even have these thoughts, have the possibility of thinking about economic fairness, social justice, equal opportunities for all people. Sadly, in our state capitals and in our national capital, we find too many politicians of either political party willing even to talk about these values, much less attempt to implement them. Of course, I think our problem there is we've got too many 5-watt bulbs sitting in 100-watt sockets, if you know what I mean. But as a result of their dimness, we've got a darkness descending across our land. You hear from Washington and Wall Street and from the media about unprecedented prosperity washing across America, unstoppable prosperity. It will not cease. It is endless. Times have never been so good. Money Magazine, I think it was in July, had a cover article said, everyone's getting rich. Well, I think you can go to neighborhood after neighborhood right here in Colorado Springs and find another truth, and that is that in the midst of this so-called prosperity that is sweeping our country, 80% of Americans, 8 out of 10 of us, have seen our incomes go flat or go down. That's true in the 1990s. 80% of us have not enjoyed the prosperity. Our incomes have not gone up. They've been flat at best and gone down. Do you know that the average wage in America today is beneath what it was when Richard Nixon was president?
Jim Hightower, former Secretary of Agriculture of the state of Texas, he is talking about Election 2000, what he calls a space odyssey. We'll continue with him in just a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with Jim Hightower, he's political commentator, former statewide office holder in Texas, former Secretary of Agriculture. As he continues with his speech, which he gave recently in Colorado Springs, Colorado, Election 2000, A Space Odyssey.
Is this prosperity? America is prosperous, but Americans are not. It's a strange kind of prosperity, it seems to me. Even though it's the labor, the creativity, the productivity, the enterprise of ordinary folks, that 80% majority out there that has generated this economic growth, and there's no question we're generating more income gain than has ever been generated perhaps in the history of the world. Productivity is up, profits are up, stock values are up. They say, look at Wall Street. My God, Hightower, what are you talking about? Look at the Dow Jones. Wall Street's whizzing. And most people look at each other and say, well, yeah, Wall Street's whizzing on you and me, if you think about it. A corporate executive punts 2,000, 20,000, 40,000 workers. What happens to the stock of that company? it goes up. We have a built-in economic incentive for chief executive officers to fire massive numbers of people because their personal compensation is attached to the value of the stock. And that's happening. That's what all these mergers are about. It's not about competitiveness. It's not about economic efficiencies. It's about driving up that stock value. Because Wall Street enjoys, and the chief executive officer and those in the executive suite enjoy, stock options. That means their income will rise. In my book, and we are going to have a little signing out back here, there's nothing in the middle of the road but yellow stripes and dead armadillos. You're allowed a full page in books these days to put a simple quote to express your full theology and philosophy just in one little pungent moment here. Several trees died to make this possible, but I chose an old cowboy saying out of West Texas, "Speak the truth, but ride a fast horse." And the truth is that what we have happening in this country is a class war. Not a class war in the sense that you might have been taught in your history books about the many storming the bastions of the few, but rather a class war waged by the few from behind their barricades of Wall Street and Washington, lobbing economic bomb after economic bomb into the middle class and into the poor neighborhoods of this country. Now, on Sunday morning, you can watch the political yak shows, and there will be the tightly bow-tied George Will. And if anybody dare to come before George Will and say, "Well, George, you know, not everybody is fully participating in this prosperity," he'll lash out at them immediately, as he has done time and again, and say, "Class war, you're trying to foment class war in America." Well, too late for that, Limbaugh breath. We've got class war. 20, 30, 40 years we've had class war being waged against the ordinary people in this country. You want class war? While our jobs are being privatized, downsized, riffed and stiff, reduced to temporary, part-time, low-wage work, the top bosses, meanwhile, running off to the bank with a big smile on their face. Chief executive officers in America today getting fatter than butcher's dog. They average $10.6 million a year in pay. We can put a person's name to this. Well, first we'll take a little show of hands. How many here made... and don't be ashamed of the balcony. Go ahead and raise your hands. $287,000 last year. Typical professor salary here. $287,000. Less than 1% of the American people make that amount of money in a year. 1%. One who did was Mikey Eisner. He's chief mouseketeer down here at Disney, Inc. Michael Eisner made $287,000 last year, but not for the year, not for a month's worth of work, not for a week's worth of work, not for a day's worth of work. That's what Michael Eisner made an hour last year, $287,000, plus a car. At the same time, he was trying to take away the health care benefits of the minimum wage workers that he dresses up as Goofy and Pluto and the gang at Disney World and Disneyland. Some of these guys are getting so rich they can afford to air condition hell, and I think from the way they're acting, they better be setting some money aside for that project. But I want to be clear here. This is not about making money. I'm in favor of people making money, making a lot of money. I'm with Mark Twain on this. Mark Twain said, "I'm opposed to millionaires, but it would be dangerous to offer me the position." The Bible doesn't say that money is the root of all evil. It says the love of money is the root of all evil. And that's what's been unleashed in our land today. The love of money. Greed, in other words. Replacing the ethic of the common good, of we're all in this together. Instead, with an ethic of "I got mine, you get yours. Never give a sucker an even chance. I'm rich and you're not. Adios, chump," is pretty much what it gets down to. That's what I oppose. It's the disparity that we're talking about. That is a class war. Because all of the people are participating in the generation of the growth of the economic pie, and yet the money is going to the top. You want class war? Washington cynically dumped 13 million welfare moms on the street saying, "Get a job," when they knew there was no job. And they knew that even though there was a job, there was no daycare, there was no transportation, there was no support system to be able to obtain the job, to maintain the job. And they knew that dumping 13 million welfare moms on the street at the same time was going to further depress the wages of the people who are out there scrambling to get a job in America today. Oh, yeah, I know you say, well, unemployment's down to 4.1%. Bill Clinton says, I've created 23 million jobs since I've been president. And you can go to any bar here, and there'll be a waitress saying, yeah, I know, I got three of them. There's plenty of work. There's just no pay for the work. That's class war. In New Jersey, Governor Christy Whitman over there, she's one of these welfare-to-work governors, mighty tough on welfare moms. Her program's called New Jersey Works. She's punted people off of the welfare rolls there. Two-thirds of the people who are off the welfare rolls in New Jersey still have no jobs 2 years after they've left. Half of those who have been punted off the welfare rolls and have no jobs have lost their homes. They're in shelters or they're trying to scramble in with families or they're homeless. You want class war? Follow the toxic fumes. Pollution tends to be a class issue. If it spews, burbles, blasts, oozes, emits, gushes, radiates, or otherwise does something unpleasant, chances are it's located in a working class, rural, minority, or low-income neighborhood, or some combination thereof. If you're poor, your chances of living next door to Mr. Toxic are quite excellent. If you're wealthy, your chances are almost zero. I've always felt we could solve the pollution problems in our country with a simple regulation passed nationally. Doesn't take a big book to figure it out, a lot of rules. It's just simply this, that any corporation that wants to create a toxic facility or a toxic dump is free to do so as long as the chief executive officer and the boards of directors of the corporation will live within 100 yards of that facility. Don't you think we'd clean it up in a hurry if that were to happen? If it was their neighborhood? You want class war? Bill Clinton, George Bush the elder, the former president, Colin Powell, gathered together in a cynical example of class war about 2 years ago in Philadelphia in what was called the Presidential Volunteerism Summit. And the announcement of both political parties was that the era of big government is over, government can't get involved in dealing with poverty issues and etc. And so we must have people contributing more to charity. We need people to be more philanthropic than they are today. Well, charity. I'll tell you a quick story that Earl Long, when he was governor of Louisiana, used to tell about charity. It tells about what the gods think of charity. It's about a rich man who died and tried to get into heaven. But if you study the Bible at all, you know that you just don't go into heaven. You appear at the pearly gates, right? And there is an angel in front of the pearly gates going to review your life. And back behind is St. Peter going to render judgment about whether you get to come in or not. So this rich man appears and the angel looks over his life and says, my God, you never did no good for nobody no way. Why are you even here? And the rich man said, not true. 1924, there was a widow woman on the street. She needed carfare home and I gave her a nickel. Angel said, well? And he said, well, 1934, there was a blind beggar man on the street and I put a nickel in his cup. Angel said, this doesn't make up for a life of greed. And the rich man said, well, I have a consistent pattern of philanthropy. In 1944, coming out of my bank at Christmas time, there was a Salvation Army there and I put a nickel in the kettle. And the angel turns back to St. Peter and says, what in the world are we going to do with this man? And St. Peter said, give him back his 15 cents and tell him to go to hell. It's not charity that we want. It's economic fairness, social justice, equal opportunity for all people. That's what America is about. It's not about charity. Economists have a technical term for what Washington and Wall Street are doing to us. Their technical term is stealing. Faster than a Bob Packwood kiss. Think about that. It's ugly. Stealing from us. Remember that verse that Woody Guthrie had and that song that he wrote back during the Depression about outlaws? Said, as through this world I travel, I see lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six gun and some with a fountain pen. It's the fountain pens who are doing the serious stealing in our society today. So here we come into the millennial presidential election. Shrub, Al, Bill, Donnie Trump, Daffy Duck, and the whole comical crew. Let me introduce to you our darling governor from the state of Texas, George W. Bush. Being a Texan, I feel a heavy burden, a responsibility to come to the countryside and share some of our personal insights into the man who would be your president. As you've heard, he's not exactly bent over double with intellect. That's true. But he says he's a Republican with a heart. Compassionate conservative, don't you understand? Well, I'm here to tell you it's just another corporate wet dream. A prince of privilege who was born on third and thinks he hit a triple. One of his chief political platforms is education reform, the essence of which there should be no social promotion. We've got to quit giving favoritism to these kids moving up. No more social promotion. As Lily Tomlin once said, no matter how cynical you get, it's almost impossible to keep up. No more social promotion? This from George W. Bush? Who was a C-minus student at Andover Prep School, but got into Yale University? Could it be because his daddy went to Yale and was a contributor? Could it be because his granddaddy went to Yale and was a contributor? Would that be possible? Affirmative action alive and well for rich white guys? George W. got into the National Guard during the Vietnam War. A war he was not eager to go to, nor was I. Nor were most people in that period. George W. was so eager not to go to war that he managed to move ahead of 100,000 other people who were on the list to get into the Air National Guard. Now, how did he move ahead of 100,000 others? Could it have been because of social promotion? Could it have been because his father was a member of the Congress at the time? Now, George W. Bush says today, I never asked to get into the National Guard. I never asked for special privilege. And he said, my father never asked for special privilege, as though that settles it, right? Now, if you are of the class of the Bushes, you don't have to ask. You have other people who ask for you. And there was an oil man millionaire buddy of George the Senior, who called the Speaker of the House of the Texas House of Representatives, who was in charge of appealing for entry into the National Guard, who then now admits he personally called the head of the Air National Guard and got George W. Bush in ahead of 100,000 other people. Now, do you think that guy just woke up one morning and was there with his post-toasties and said, you know, I think I'll call the Speaker of the Texas House and ask him to call the head of the Air National Guard in Texas and help George W. Bush get into the Air National Guard? I think it was social promotion is what it was. Social promotion? George W. Bush, a failed businessman, overage frat boy, hanging around the White House in the 1980s because he had nothing to do. He had been put into the oil business by his father's friends, and he had failed at that. They had gone bankrupt. When suddenly a man named Richard Rainwater entered the picture. You don't know Richard Rainwater, but if you read Forbes magazine's Forbes Richest 400 Americans, you will find Richard Rainwater there. He's worth $1.5 billion, or that's what he says he's worth. Richard Rainwater, among others, was buying the Texas Rangers baseball team. Back in 1989, And they decided on whim, let's bring in George W. Bush to be a partner in the Texas Rangers baseball game. So George W. borrowed $600,000 from a bank that he had been a director of before and bought into the Rangers, a minuscule amount of the whole purchase price. But they named him general manager of the Texas Rangers. That doesn't mean that he actually managed anything. In fact, the Rangers never managed to get out of fourth place in the American League West, which it was very difficult to achieve that during that period. But nonetheless, they stood sunk down in there. But George W. Bush wasn't managing anything. He was the PR front man for the team. And PR front man meant he was also the one that went before the public saying, we need a sales tax increase here in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex to be able to build a new stadium for the Texas Rangers baseball team. And they got that passed. And then George W. Bush was able to campaign for governor of the state of Texas on the basis that I am a successful businessman, as evidenced by the fact that I've been general manager of the Texas Rangers baseball team. And he put all of his holdings into a blind trust, put it in a hat and turned it upside down. He couldn't see it, he said, except for one holding that he left out, the Texas Rangers baseball team. And last year, he was part of the negotiations that sold the Texas Rangers baseball team. And his share, based on his $600,000 investment of the sales price, was $2.5 million. It's a pretty good return on a, what's that, seven-year investment. But then the partners turned around and gave him a bonus of $12.5 million. He made $15 million on a $600,000 investment in 7 years. And he just happened to be the sitting governor at the time. And so it came payback time. And Richard Rainwater came forward. The state of Texas, while George W. Bush has been governor of our fair state, has sold state buildings to Rainwater's real estate company at bargain basement prices, beneath the cost, the market price of it. State college and public school funds have been invested in Richard Rainwater's companies. A Bush-sponsored tax cut that ended up failing, but nonetheless he pushed it, would have cut millions of dollars in annual taxes for Richard Rainwater's real estate holdings. He passed a stadium financing bill that gave $10 million to Richard Rainwater. And he vetoed a patient's bill of rights in the state of Texas. Richard Rainwater happens to own Columbia HCA HMOs, one of the largest HMO chains in the country. And that patient's bill of rights would have worked against Richard Rainwater. Now, what this is crony capitalism that we accuse the Russians of practicing and the Malaysians and others. But in fact, of course, we practice it here. And that's who George W. Bush is. Now, we did have one moment in the session of the legislature early this year in which we were stunned to hear George W. Bush suddenly, in what appeared to be perhaps a compassionate conservative hormonal surge or something, rush out and say, people are hurting. And we thought, my God, yes, George, people are hurting here in the state of Texas. We have more poor people, percentage-wise, than any state in the nation. In fact, we have more children without health care coverage than any state in the nation. Perhaps he was thinking about the children. But no, he said, Exxon is hurting. Oil prices were down. And so he declared as his number one legislative emergency bill a $45 million tax subsidy to Exxon.
Jim Hightower, former Secretary of Agriculture of the state of Texas, his new book is called If the Gods Had Meant Us to Vote, They Would Have Given Us Candidates. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Cheered by flag-waving Cubans, the grandmothers of Elian Gonzalez returned to Cuba on Sunday to a celebrity welcome after a U.S. trip that stirred public opinion but failed to bring their grandson home. Thousands of Cuban citizens turned out to give a warm and massive reception to the grandmothers, Mariela Quintana and Raquel Rodriguez. Bursting into tears at the end of the official welcome, Elian's maternal grandmother, Rodriguez, expressed sorrow that they had not returned with their grandson. She said, "We have to keep fighting. We promised Elian we would bring him back to Cuba." The women spent 9 days in the United States lobbying for the return of the six-year-old, who's at the center of a highly politicized custody tug-of-war between his father in Cuba and distant exiled relatives in Miami. They were welcomed like heads of states. The grandmothers, the two women, rode from Havana Airport in an open-top government black Mercedes, along with Elian's father, Juan Miguel Gonzalez, and they met with Cuban President Fidel Castro. We're joined on the telephone right now by Reverend Lucius Walker. He heads Pastors for Peace in New York. He was in Miami this past week and weekend for a protest. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Reverend Walker.
Amy, it's good to be here.
Can you tell us about this week that you spent in Florida?
It was a most inspiring and exciting weekend. On Saturday, approximately 400 people, most of them from Miami itself and more than 150 from around the country, gathered in Miami to make our public case in the heart of Miami at the INS building there for the return of Elian to his father in Cuba. The gathering was very diverse. It was very spirited. Our message was single, focused, the return of Elian. We condemned the delay which the INS has engaged in, and we condemned the doublespeak of the INS because they have made the right determination that the son should be returned to his father, but they have failed miserably in their implementation of their own decision. Indeed, some of us are now convinced that the delay was intentional in order to give the distant relatives in Miami and the Cuban American National Foundation and their paid members of Congress time to create legislative and judicial hurdles for the return of the child. We also condemned very strongly the sister Jean McLaughlin, who was to have been a neutral observer, providing a neutral site for the meeting of the grandparents with their grandson, only to have her within less than 24 hours make her own statement that she felt the child should stay in Miami. And after that, we learned from a number of sources that her college was in financial trouble, and the Cuban-American National Foundation bailed her college out. So she was not neutral from the very beginning. This has been a fiasco. It's been, I think, foisting a cruel hoax on the U.S. public and, of course, upon poor Elian and his father.
Reverend Walker, you're well known for challenging U.S. policy towards Cuba. You have been running the friend shipment caravans to Cuba. You've been arrested. You've been on hunger strikes to challenge the embargo to get medicine and other goods into Cuba. How does that connect to what we're seeing today with Elian Gonzalez?
Because of our demonstrated solidarity with Cuba, our interest in normalizing relations between the U.S. and Cuba, the pastors in Cuba know of our concern. They appeal to us to do whatever we could to assist in the return of Elian. So the connection is very direct. The partners that we work with primarily in Cuba ask if we would take on this issue because there is no greater expression of solidarity with Cuba these days, they've told us, than the return of Elian. So we're involved because of that. But I must tell you, Amy, that I'm trained as a social worker, And one area of my social work specialty was in child welfare, foster and adoptive care. And in that capacity, I am deeply steeped in the fundamental, the unyielding principle of social work, that children belong with their natural parents unless there are very gross extenuating circumstances. In this case, there are no extenuating circumstances. Even the INS has declared that Juan Gonzalez is a fit father, that he speaks for the child. They have ample evidence based on two extensive interviews with him. And therefore, out of my social work background and with all of this information which comes from the INS itself, I'm deeply disturbed that this child is being separated from his father and being economically and politically exploited by those distant relatives in Miami and their handlers and their advisors. This is a case of child abuse, pure and simple. It should not have been politicized. It simply should have been resolved by the INS within days of the snatching of this child from the sea.
You know, I'm interested in a comparison we don't hear very much. Here you have Elian Gonzalez at this point not returned to his father in Cuba. And at the same time, you have Vice President Gore being, well, to say the least, wishy-washy on the issue of Elian Gonzalez and whether he should return. He hasn't even been as strong as Janet Reno and the Attorney General saying that perhaps he should stay here. And yet you see him expending no political capital when it comes to, for example, Lori Berenson, who's been imprisoned in Peru for 4 years. She's an American citizen, clearly faces grave danger. No one says that her trial was fair. And you and I got a chance to meet with Lori Berenson last year in Peru. What do you think about that comparison?
The difference is very clear. The Cuban American National Foundation has put at least $179,000 into Gore's campaign. Lori Berenson's parents are not in a position to, even if they were disposed to, pay for the services of the Vice President of the United States. I think Gore has sold himself, just as other politicians in this matter have. He has no principal conviction. His sole interest is election at any cost, and I think he's made it very clear that he will be spineless, he will be wishy-washy, as you said. He will not stand up for the rights of this child under U.S. law and under international law because the money is not there. I think it's a shame to say that politics in this country is driven by money, but I think your listenership would be sophisticated enough to know that that unfortunately is the case. Lori Berenson has every reason under the obligations of the State Department and our government to have the advocacy of her government for her release. Our government refuses consistently to do so. But I am sure that if enough money were paid by her family to our own elected officials, they would speak on her behalf. And it's just that crass, and it's just that despicable. But there are other factors involved in how the high officials of our government respond differently to different, very similar, though different situations. Take, for example, the fact that just a few days after Elian Gonzalez was picked up on the high seas, a boatload of 400 Haitians was picked up. One of the women, because of illness, was kept in the States for medical attention, possibly an operation. All of the others, including her own two children, just two toddlers, were returned to Haiti. And we know that the return to Haiti means not only economic deprivation, but possibly some sort of reprisal by the FRAP. And these two children, much younger than Elian, were returned without parents, without family, And only when that was discovered in Haiti, here they were on this dock with no place to go, with no one to care for them. And the public outcry forced the U.S. to return them to their mother until the mother is able to go back to Haiti. Racism, in that case, and the refusal of Lori Berenson's parents to pay a bribe in their case. But the Cuban American National Foundation has raised more than $4 million, more than $4 million in their campaign using poor little Ilion as a poster child, as their fundraiser. So he is sort of a goose that has laid the golden egg for this, for the Cuban American National Foundation and for this distant so-called uncle, who has been able, because of the money he's raised by pimping off of Ilion, to quit his job as an auto body repair person. He has a new wardrobe. He bought a new Lexus after retiring from his job. Ilion is like a cash cow for them. They're holding on to him because he's an economic prize, not because they really care for the child.
And what about the response in Miami? We're getting pretty uniform pictures in the media of, a furious community that wants to keep Elian Gonzalez there. Now, we don't as much see the polls in the United States that indicate overwhelmingly people feel he should be reunited with his father. Even Alan Keyes, the Republican presidential candidate, has said that he thinks family values trumps ideology.
Well, I have just spent almost a week in Miami, and I can tell you that the media, as well as the judges and the politicians in Miami, are intimidated and controlled by money from the right-wing element in the exiled Cuban-American community. Some of the reporters will tell you that they file stories, but the stories somehow never get on the air. The demonstration which we did got very little coverage in Miami. The major coverage, and it was a major demonstration, a major breakthrough, the wall of fear that the right-wing exile community has created there. It got coverage outside. The same networks that fed their stories to their local affiliates, those networks didn't run it, but the networks in Pittsburgh and Chicago and California and New York, they ran the story. There's such intimidation and control that it's frightening. It's frightening. How else can you account for the control and the duplicity and the sudden turnaround of this nun who had this tremendous opportunity to do the right thing, to simply be neutral? And what would it, I mean, what must have been the motivation for her to violate one of the most sacred trusts of the religious leadership?
Well, Reverend Lucius Walker, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Reverend Lucius Walker is head of Pastors for Peace and a Cuba friend shipment caravan that for years has been challenging the U.S. embargo against Cuba. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy.
Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman from the studios of WBAI in New York. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!